Well, my experience on February 7th was like many others. I was listening to the radio, ABC radio, and watching the CFA website for the warnings all morning. The government and authorities have warned us all week that it was going to be an atrocious day. So I was doing what I thought was the right thing and listening for warnings. By about lunchtime, it was clear from the radio broadcast that things were looking fairly bleak, and the warnings on the website started being a little bit out of date with what was happening on the radio. Mm-hmm. And so my wife got home at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I said to her, Carmen, a caller's called up and said there's fire impacting on Whittlesea. And she said, yeah, but Whittlesea's ages away, isn't it? And I said, you're kidding me. I mean, you know, if it gets into the national park, we're stuffed. And I said, I think we really should go. Walked outside and stood on the veranda and looked out towards the direction of Whittlesea to the northwest of where my house was. And it was red and it was very hazy, and the wind was just unbelievably violent. And my house is located on the side of the mountain in King Lake, south, sort of southwest facing. And I thought, this is not looking good. And so after about an hour or so, we just calmly packed a bag and jumped in the car. And by the time we walked out of the house, the sensor lights had come on outside. It was getting that dark. And yeah, it was a very weird, eerie sort of feeling. But we drove down the mountain and went to my mother's in Hurstbridge, which is down the bottom of the mountain. And within an hour or so, listening to the radio down there, we heard that fires had come through, and so we went up and stood on my friend's deck in a nearby town and just watched the mountains burn.
Knowing that your house was amongst it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I always knew that if there was a fire anywhere near King Lake, our house would be the first to go. It's it was not well prepared. We knew that when we moved. So straight away we knew that the house was gone.
You talk about a range of conditions there, a range of experiences, things that you saw and heard, but was there one trigger that made you go, we're in the car, we're out of here?
I think it was the expressions and the tone of the voice on the presenter, the ABC presenter's voice. They were broadcasting from the main control room, and nothing they actually said was alarming, but I could hear the fire controller's voice change, and the ABC broadcaster saying that the board is lighting up, there are fires everywhere. And then walking out onto the veranda and just seeing the violence in the wind, the trees blowing, I just thought, no, forget about the warnings. I don't want to be anywhere near here. And so we left.
You'd faced bushfire before? You'd experienced this before?
No, I hadn't. Where we lived, it was surrounded by bush on an escarpment, very steep slope. And I just knew that the place was not defendable at all, and that if a bushfire did come through, that we wouldn't have a chance. So we always knew that. We accepted that. We had all of our precious belongings, our photos, they were all backed up. We always knew or anticipated or prepared for the worst. So, you know, in some ways we sort of knew that it was undefendable, our house, and the only option for us was to leave. If a fire was anywhere near the mountain, that was our bottom line. If a fire is anywhere near King Lake, we're out of there. It just so happens that on that particular day, we didn't appreciate how fast the fires would move, and we got out just in time, really.
The sort of things you're talking about there point to a bushfire survival plan that many are encouraged to put in place now. You point to, you know, if the fire gets to this mountain, we're out of here. They're the sort of things we're asked to consider in a bushfire survival plan. Did you have a plan like that in place already, or you just decided that that was the case?
No, like a lot of people, we didn't have a written bushfire survival plan. And again, in hindsight, I wouldn't have been there at all that day. I would have left the night before. It's not the safest option. The safest option always is to leave early. But we didn't have code red days before Black Saturday.
No.
So, you know, for me, the code red day, the new code red, is probably the best thing they've ever done. I mean, it's very clear now what code red means. And you definitely can't stay and defend or wait and see. We were lucky that time, but boy, I wouldn't like to be there again in a code red day.
You talk about code red days. Am I right in thinking that in New South Wales, a code red day would be described as catastrophic? That would be the fire rating given to a code red day?
That's right. Yeah. I would have thought they were the same uniform across the country, but yes, code red or catastrophic. We tend to use code red down in Victoria.
Yes.
Means the same thing. Mm-hmm. It means if you're living anywhere near the bush or vegetation in general, you really, really don't want to wait and see what happens. You really need to be well away from the bush. And in my experience, we left it a little bit too late for comfort, and I wouldn't have been there at all on that day had that code red warning been issued.
You talk about hindsight, and in hindsight you would have left the night before. It sounds like a hairy drive from your place to your mother's place.
An extremely hairy drive. At that time, of course, it was an eerie, ominous, just awkward feeling driving down the windy mountain. We were driving down that. We were the only ones on the road until we got to the bottom in St Andrews, and we saw we had our lights on, and a bunch of four-wheel drives and other vehicles raced up the mountain in a big hurry with their lights on. And I remember thinking, something's going on here. Again, in hindsight, we didn't realise that the fire was already impacting St Andrews, and we just drove through it calmly without any awareness that the fire was within probably minutes, perhaps an hour, from impacting that same road we travelled down.
Mm. Sends a chill up your spine, I bet.
Oh, it does now, absolutely. Yeah. And coming to terms with the fact that we left just in time when so many others in our community didn't has been difficult to swallow. It's proved very hard. There is some sense of survivor's guilt.
Houses that did survive the fire, what do you put that down? What did those people do? You say your house was undefendable. You'd already made the decision to go. But the houses that did survive, that were defended, what worked for them? Why did they survive?
Well, all of the houses in my area on that side of town were gone. And so I don't know of any houses, well, all of them that I know of didn't survive just because of the way the direction of the southwesterly wind change sent the fire racing up the mountain, and we were on that side of the mountain. But the good thing about that was all of the people in my neighbourhood survived. Some of them had close escapes. They had an opportunity to get out of their houses onto the road and into town, which was relatively safe. No one in that neighbourhood, my neighbourhood, tried to stay and defend. It was not an option. We were living in the bush, and no amount of defending or preparation would have helped.
Are you guys rebuilding at the moment? Where's your life at now?
We are rebuilding. We had to rebuild on the same location for financial reasons.
Yes.
That was quite a headache, the aftermath and the rebuilding process. We're still not there yet. We're not living in a house that's up to the code, the new building codes that have come through after the fires have caused a bit of a headache for us. And we're working with the authorities to try and find a way to get our house up to code. We're in the flame zone. There's not many houses that are in the flame zone, and building in the new flame zone is quite expensive and tricky. So we're hoping that we do get the house up to code and can stay there. Otherwise, we face the real possibility of being evicted being told to demolish our house.
Mm.
It's an ongoing dilemma. It's an ongoing problem. And a lot of that was caused by the financial situation and the insurance arrangements and so on after the fires came through. A whole bunch of different policies and actions sort of contributed to making rebuilding very difficult, not just for us, but for many, many people around King Lake.
What can you tell us about that experience, I guess that paperwork, insurance side of things, that perhaps the rest of us can learn from?
Well, I think when we moved to our property, we always just said, well, we're insured, so if we lose the house, we'll just rebuild or we'll get a payout. And unfortunately, what I don't think a lot of people realise, well, at least in our situation, when we lost our house, the insurance company declared a total loss and said, yes, you've lost your house, obviously, and we'll pay out the sum insured for the building. What we didn't anticipate was that insurance money would go to our mortgager, our lender, not us, to pay off the mortgage. So we were left with, we didn't actually get the insurance money. So when people say, were you insured? And we say, yes, they go, oh, okay, you'll be right.
Mm.
But we didn't get that money. That money went off our mortgage. And then the mortgager, the home lender, sent out a valuer to assess the value of our property and absolutely decimated the value of our property. And so we were left with a mortgage on a valueless piece of land, no rebuilding money as such. And so we were financially, in a rock and a hard place. the only way we would manage to put a house back on that property, and it's a very small, modest house, was because of the bushfire appeal fund. Mm-hmm. So we used every cent of that to rebuild, put a house on the property, and then we went to another bank and were able to get a mortgage to finish off some works and so on. But we're still not there yet. So I think people really need to have a look at their insurance policy and the arrangements between their home lender and the insurance company and factor that in, because you might not necessarily get the money to rebuild.
The experience you point to, was it a circumstance of your particular policy, or is it how the industry works in general?
I think it's a combination of both. I think if we had I think it's a genuine arrangement between insurance companies and home lenders. Mm-hmm. If we had of challenged it, like some others did, perhaps they could have had a better outcome. But at the time, we're talking a few days after the fires when all this happened, we were none the wiser, and we just accepted that was standard practice, and it was well within their rights. And after the home lender got the insurance money, they said to us, well, we're not going to lend you any more money to rebuild. So it was only because of the good grace and generosity of the public that we were able to rebuild.
David, you touched on the specs around the new fire building code before and the fact that you're wrestling with that at the moment. Can you give us an insight into some of those specs and some of the things that you're having to include in the design of your new home?
Sure. When the building codes came in, there wasn't a period of transition. So they came in straight away. And unfortunately, what we found was that the industry, the building industry, hadn't had time to do the R&D, the research and development, to create products to meet the new flame zone, to test them to the new Australian standard. So it's only recently that, I think in the last 6 to 12 months, that we've even got an approved fire shutter for windows. And they're very, very expensive. For our very, very small house, the cost of approved fire shutters that meet the new standards is over $25,000.
Right.
So at the time when the former government released these codes, or I think it was a national thing anyway, they estimated that it would cost $20,000 to $30,000 more to rebuild in a flame zone. Mm-hmm. And that's well and truly been acknowledged as absolutely untrue. It's extremely expensive to build in the flame zone. It's difficult to get the permission to do so in the first place. And then to find the products to meet that flame zone rating, it's hugely expensive.
Would you have rather rebuilt somewhere else?
I guess, yes, ideally, I think so. I wake up every day now and see the bush growing back, and there's a wall of saplings around my property that are probably 2 metres high now, and you can't even see through them. And so the threat, the hazard, is increasing every single day, and it's a constant reminder of bushfire and the threat. So within a couple of years, we're going to be faced with the same potential threat as we did on February 7th.
As that bush starts to regenerate and regrow and restore itself, will you manage that bushland around your home any differently than you have in the past before the fire?
Look, we're doing a lot more thinning out and burning off and trying to manage it as best we can. And I guess after the fires, the whole town, I guess you can understandably appreciate, almost declared war on vegetation.
Yes.
And did a lot of clearing and burning off, but there's only so much you can do. Mm. I live within 100 metres of the national park, which is largely unmanaged. So I can clear 50 metres around my house, and that makes a huge difference. However, we've also got to look at the bigger picture and look at the national park that completely surrounds my house on three sides and just think, well, how much thinning out and property management on my particular plot will make a difference, particularly on those extreme and catastrophic rating days. That's still not going to be an option. So even when our house is up to flame zone rating, which I hope it is, I still would not stay. I don't think there is any building that I know of, unless it's a concrete bunker under the ground, that could withstand the sort of fire that we saw on February 7th.
We've talked about your personal recovery, but what about the wider Kinglake community? How's the rest of the community going?
Not as well as everyone would hope, including myself. I think it's, I guess I don't know the numbers, but I don't think, I think there's probably a maximum of 50% of the residents have rebuilt. I don't know what the figures are, but it doesn't seem like everyone has moved back and have finished rebuilding. There are a lot of issues with rebuilding and so on. And look, the community is resilient and there's a lot going on that's positive. I wonder at the two-year mark, a bit over 2 years, no one would have thought that it would take so long to rebuild and recover. I mean, you speak to anyone that's built a house normally under normal circumstances, the stress is quite heavy. You combine that with people who have experienced such a disaster where their whole community has been ravaged by fire and loss of life and property. You know, you talk to anyone up the street and the topic of conversation is rebuilding and all the problems associated with rebuilding. So you're living in a bizarre community or a bizarre situation where everyone's facing the same things, which can be strengthening as well as demoralising. But, look, there's been... I can't speak for everyone up there, but I do know that there is a lot of good things happening, a lot of resilience and strength. But at the same time, there's also a lot of people who are struggling with the 2 year mark where that energy starts dropping off, the adrenaline's gone now, and people are challenged with the sort of emotional and physical recovery after such a prolonged period of stress. And that can take time, and we've got good support, so you know it will happen. Recovery is a process; it's not something that can be marked by an end date. So from what I see, people are getting on as best they can.
I understand you now work for the Country Fire Authority in Victoria, the equivalent of our rural fire service. When you tell people your story, what's the one thing you want to leave with them about your story that you hope might help them if they ever find themselves in the situation you did?
Well, my job with the Country Fire Authority here is to, I'm an education officer working with secondary schools to try and get bushfire on the curriculum to have more students engaged with bushfires and bushfire safety to be better prepared in the future. I spent a lot of time after the fires as a teacher working with students from King Lake who had experienced disaster, and we did a good project. We wrote a book called From King Lake to Kabul, which talks about some of the experiences of the young people there, and then that process was healing. And now, after 2 years of working on that project in a recovery sense, I'm really pleased to be working in an organisation on preparedness and bushfire safety. It feels much better to now take the lessons that I learned from bushfire and working with young people to helping them better prepare for the future. Mm-hmm. And we know so much about bushfire now. We have a history, Victoria at least, and no doubt New South Wales has bushfire disasters are part of our heritage, and we must learn from those disasters and we must be better prepared in the future. And it's an important job to get the message out there that bushfires, I guess, in themselves aren't particularly new or dangerous in themselves. It's when they intersect with people, and that's the thing we can control. We can't control catastrophic bushfire behaviour on days that we saw on February 7th. What we can control is our own behaviour and where we are on those days. And we absolutely need to be very, very mindful that you just can't be there anywhere near the bush on catastrophic or extreme days. I mean, that is the bottom line for me.
David, really appreciate you sharing your story during Bushfire Awareness Week here in New South Wales. Thank you so much.
No problem. Appreciate it.